It's really so sad, you know. You look at, and particularly American culture is emblematic of this. You go to a typical shopping mall and look at the people around you and the environment around you, and the utter shallowness and hopelessness of it all is profoundly depressing.
That now confront us are as much moral as practical, as much philosophical as pragmatic. The myth of endless growth that has so driven Western economies over the past two centuries is now confronted by the reality of a seriously damaged world. We have failed to honour our duty as stewards of an exquisitely beautiful planet, and have instead treated the created world as an endless commodity into which we can project our technocratic fantasies and unload the toxic detritus of industrial activity without any thought of consequence. While governments dither and corporate behemoths evade and obstruct the growing collective will for a more conscious participation in our fate, we are more likely to be herded towards the flames than guided towards more appropriate ways of living on the earth in this time of gathering storms. Let us continue, individually and collectively, to work towards the creation of enduring communities, to cut through the destructive effects of greed and ignorance, and strive to preserve and perpetuate those sources of wisdom that will enable future generations to avoid the tragic errors that presently unfold around us.
To continue the way that we're living, regardless of whether the planet is heating up or not? Do we want to inherit an Earth that looks like this? Splitting hairs over the degree of temperature rise on the planet is in fact a red herring to the obvious and rampant environmental destruction that's taking place. And we're fools if we think that this destruction will not eventually impact on us.
We're definitely in a trap. We're in a systemic trap, which is not just a trap by evil people who sort of planned this from the beginning, but it's actually a systemic trap. It's a trap of structural addiction where the system can't stop, because if it stops, the consequences are horrific, but if it goes on, the consequences are horrific.
Thank you. In a very real sense, the Earth has two completely different personalities. One temperament seems calm and benign, well in control of the forces locked within the Earth or playing around its biosphere. The other is a hard, hostile, often deadly nature, a nature racked and tormented by these same forces rampaging out of control.
Earth as a whole is a great system. Now, what do we mean by a system? It means that it's pretty obvious, really, that everything is interconnected. That the land, the oceans, the rocks, the atmosphere, and the living creatures are all connected in one great system. So that anything that happens to any part of the system will ramify through the whole and can shift it to new states. But before Lovelock, the idea was that the living beings couldn't possibly affect water terribly much, or the rocks, or the atmosphere. They had to adapt to these things, but they couldn't really influence them very much. But Lovelock showed how, in fact, living beings do influence the atmosphere, rocks and water. For example, without any life, you can show that there would be no water now on the planet, because living beings, particularly bacteria, are able to keep water around on the planet. This demonstrates what Lynn Margulis has said, I think, several times, that it's the microbes that rule the world.
Lines I ever wrote was that forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. When you think of the plains and hillsides of Iraq as the first thing that you normally think of, cedar forests so thick the sunlight never touches the ground. I think for most of us that's not the case, but the first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh cutting down those forests to make cities.
Fools if we think that this destruction will not eventually impact on us.
There was a great thing that James Lovelock once said when he spoke about, you know, a rather deep ecology perspective, I think, where he said that what we're doing, what humans are doing, is as if the brain were to decide it was the most important organ in the body and started mining the liver.
Perspective as an author, philosopher, lecturer, we are also in a battle to determine what will survive of mankind's history that will be carried over after the collapse, where we will have a very painful transition phase and era that will be bloody, messy, but eventually the dust will settle. The question is, what will survive? The choice being presented to mankind now is either evolve or perish, grow up or die. Change the way you view the world and your relationship to it, because I believe this planet is alive, and I believe that we have to establish a basic fundamental connection with all life on this planet to achieve something called balance, or steady state, whatever you want to call it, sustainable, that doesn't pretend or aspire to overturn the physical laws of the universe or to make man a god, but to make man hopefully an intelligent creation living in harmony in God's universe.
Classical economics, that's the real religion of this age, and this is the most pious religion that the world has ever known, with people worshipping the Sabbath lasting 5 days a week in great skyscraping, earth-destroying buildings and malls, and its huge power comes from the fact that it's not even recognized to be a religious phenomenon. It supposes itself to be secular, but in fact it's a very insidious religion, and is consuming the earth with a fervor that the Easter Islanders could only have dreamed of.
There's another point to be made about all of this. If you try to think through the cost-benefit analysis, suppose the people who deny it are correct, and you do something about it. Okay, you've spent some money doing things you probably should have done anyway, you know, like more renewable energy and so on. But the total cost is it cost you something. Suppose, on the other hand, that the consensus is right. If you don't do anything, human species is probably down the drain. Okay, those are the costs you have to estimate. That's not particularly subtle.
One can see maybe the past logic of allegiance to a nation state that provided you with security. There's now ample evidence to show that there is no security in that nation state, and that we have to disengage from that. In a way, it's the old principles of pacifist non-participation. But the important thing is it's got to be a much more activist building the parallel world. And I think there's hope in what happened to some extent in the decline of Rome, that we can see as Rome went through its various horrendous crises and sort of various systems fell apart, that actually as the empire unraveled, conditions for ordinary people actually got better, because they weren't any longer having to support the huge taxation burden to maintain the extended armies and all of the infrastructure. And there's ample evidence to show that, to some extent, life actually improved.
We have been living is over, and that means our rules and our regulations are over. All of our rules and our regulations are relative to stick frame houses that you pump heat into, and the sewage and water regulations are all about endless amounts of energy and water, wasteful methods of living. Those days are over due to population explosion and climate change and dwindling resources. put all three of those together. You know, I don't care whether you call it global warming or whether people caused it or not, or I'm not into any of that argument. I'm just saying I'm into the unarguable aspects.
Consider again that pale blue dot. Imagine that you take a good long look at it. Imagine you're staring at the dot for any length of time. And then try to convince yourself that God created the whole universe for one of the 10 million or so species of life that inhabit that speck of dust. Now take it a step further. Imagine that everything was made just for a single shade of that species, or gender, or ethnic or religious subdivision. We can recognize here a shortcoming, in some circumstances serious, in our ability to understand the world. Characteristically, we seem compelled to project our own nature onto nature. Man, in his arrogance, thinks himself a great work, worthy of the interposition of a deity. Darwin wrote telegraphically in his notebook, "More humble, and I think truer, to consider him created from animals." Close quote. We're Johnny-come-latelys. We live in the cosmic boondocks. We emerged from microbes and muck. Apes are our cousins. Our thoughts and feelings are not fully under our own control. And on top of all this, we're making a mess of our planet and becoming a danger to ourselves. The trapdoor beneath our feet swings open. We find ourselves in bottomless freefall. If it takes a little myth and ritual to get us through a night that seems endless, who among us cannot sympathize and understand? We long to be here for a purpose, even though, despite much self-deception, none is evident. The significance of our lives and our fragile planet is then determined only by our own wisdom and courage. We are the custodians of life's meaning. We long for a parent to care for us, to forgive us our errors, to save us from our childish mistakes. But knowledge is preferable to ignorance. Better by far to embrace the hard truth than a reassuring fable. Modern science has been a voyage into the unknown, with a lesson in humility waiting at every stop. Our common sense intuitions can be mistaken. Our preferences don't count. We do not live in a privileged reference frame. If we crave some cosmic purpose, then let us find ourselves a worthy goal.
Being does have a special purpose. That purpose is to bring consciousness itself to the earth. That is to be conscious of consciousness.
It's not just that we live in such a miraculous universe, but that if we really understand it, that's who we are, that we are that universe at the moment when it's become complex enough in the form of the human species to look over its own shoulder and see the incredible road that it has travelled, and the jaw of the universe drops in awe and wonder at the miracle of the whole thing. Deep ecology is a philosophy of nature that is looking at the psychological or spiritual dimension underlying the environmental crisis. And the term was coined by Arne Næss, the late Arne Næss, who was professor of philosophy at Oslo University. And he saw that the fundamental level of the environmental crisis is the illusion of separation between human beings and the rest of the natural world, and that this stems from anthropocentrism, or human-centeredness, the idea that human beings are the center of everything. We are the crown of creation, the measure of all being, and the world consists of human beings on the one hand and resources for human beings on the other hand. So it's seen as some kind of a pyramid with human beings on the top. Whereas Indigenous people and the science of ecology recognise that a better metaphor is a web, with human beings just one strand in that web, nothing special, and as we destroy the other strands, we destroy ourselves.
The most important thing now is not what scientists think about animism. It's getting the sense that we're inside a great living creature, out into the general public, that it's okay to feel what you feel in the forest, that what you feel, that what you intuit in the forest or out in nature or by the sea, that all of that is a genuine form of communication from the earth, that the earth is actually speaking to you. That's the most important thing for us to learn now as a culture. It's very important for the scientists to do their science, and I wish they would do it in a more animistic spirit. But it doesn't matter if they don't take it on board. It's more important for the general public to take this on board. If we're business people, we can think of it like this. We're working for Gaia Inc. This is the boss, you know. The whole Earth system is the boss. Or another way I put it is that we can be Gaia'd. In other words, that the Earth herself is an active agency, almost a psychological agency, a psyche, that can sweep away the illusion of separation that we have and give us this gift of connectedness with her great vast body. We can use our science, the science of Gaia, or Earth system science if you like, to really develop a sense of deep belonging to the Earth. Because the stories that science has given us, like the ones I've outlined, are so miraculous and inspiring that we can use them to help us fall in love with the Earth.
It's time to be truthful. Millions of sensual, pulsing animal bodies are now living trapped and used and starved in cities and cubicles and sweatshops and food courts and traffic jams and suburbs and public school classrooms. People who are not rich and white already know this. What would happen if we let ourselves feel our feelings about all of this? The entire community of life on this planet is now being threatened. Where do we stick our picket pins? Where do we take a stand? When do we find the courage to let ourselves feel what is going on? Our feelings are the swiftest path back to our forgotten selves. It's time to be open and humble. There are huge forces at work in the world, both seen and unseen. It's time to ask for help. Ask the ancestors. Ask the gods. Ask your God. Go outside and lie down on the earth and ask the land and the sky and the life of this place. And then listen for a response. Listen to the voices of soil and stone, wind and water. The voices of cirrus clouds and chickadees, of red squirrels and wood beetles and Russian olives and hickories. The world will tell us what it knows. If only we will be still and listen. And then speak. It's time to show up in our own lives and tell the truth. It's time to talk about the world situation with everyone we see. We're all in this together. What a relief it'll be to discover that we are not alone. It's time to act with great intention. There is work aplenty to do in this weary world, and people engaged in that work. Find those people. Join in. Save rivers and stop bulldozers and stand up at city council meetings to tell your truth. Share skills, evolve local communities, move from agriculture to permaculture and grow your own food. Learn about medicinal herbs. As Derek Jensen says, we need it all. Find your work and do it. It's time. But what about that speeding train? How will the great turning turn? We can wait for the train to crash on its own and hope that it doesn't kill us and everything else. But with the children grown, perhaps we can come together and decide to dismantle, joyfully and with conscious intent, the rusty and dangerous old swing set of a culture that no longer serves us. This may seem an impossible task, but if the alternative is extinction, then we have nothing to lose. We humans once knew how to live on this planet. A few still do, and that's the good news. It can be done. We can do way, way better than empire.
If we don't figure out what our place in the universe is, we're not going to have a place in the universe. We're not going to have a place in the universe. Place in the universe. Place in the universe.